Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in
Brexit. Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Last Week in Brexit, the podcast all about leaving the EU. On this week's show, we've got EU citizens' rights, we've got some ID cards, the Tory split, and also there's been a new advisory group, which we will dig into. But before all that, I would just like to request you to leave a review on iTunes. The more the better, and it just helps push us up the charts and allows other people to find the work that we're doing here. As always, I'm joined by Alex Davis. Hello.
Hiya.
Alex.
You're right.
And Christian Spence.
Hello.
Right, gents, let's go straight into this. I think the big news of this week is this extended document. We had a smaller version of it a few months ago, but regarding EU citizens' rights. So, Alex, you've got the document in front of you there. What do we know?
So more than 1 year on from the referendum itself, we finally got something which pretty much everyone has been calling for the entire time, I think, in that we've got the at least the initial kind of draft proposal for what our policy on the rights of EU citizens in the UK will be going forward. So obviously this is part of the negotiations, and I don't think at this point we expect this to be how the final deal will look exactly. But already it's kind of been torn apart a little bit already. And the suggestion is that the promises for this entire time from the government have been that no rights will be taken away, and that essentially people won't notice the change. Analysis early on from legal experts and things like that have already poked a few holes in it, places where rights potentially are going to be taken away. I guess the big ones, which as far as I'm aware, are first of all this whole new status of settled status. So essentially, EU nationals which have been in the country for 5 years or more will have to apply for this new status of settled status, which will allow them to stay here for an indefinite period of time. But the big issue with that is that people who already have permanent residency rights and who have already been through the whole process are going to have to go through a whole new process. And at this point, we don't have much detail on what that process will be. It's looking like it's going to involve some kind of ID card type system. And, you know, at this point, it's very difficult to say because we don't have a lot of the detail, but potentially that means another large scale kind of IT project from the government. And we all know how those tend to go. And then the second big one, which people are pointing at, is the fact that this actually reduces the rights of EU nationals coming here in terms of bringing their family across from abroad, and that it brings those rights perfectly into line with the rights of British citizens, which apparently are some of the least favourable rights in terms of bringing family here that exist in the modern world. I'm not quite sure what those are, but those the thing about the settled status, everyone having to reapply again, the fact that it's going to become so much more difficult to bring family in, and then the final one is also the change that even if you've got this new settled status, if you leave the country for 2 years, you lose the status and then will have to go through the entire process again based on whatever the immigration policy is post-Brexit, I guess, at that time. And so people are kind of pointing to this and saying, well, actually, you've promised us that nothing's really going to change. But when you dig into the details, there's potentially some major rights being taken away.
So fundamentally, this document is trying to protect the rights of individuals who are already here, not individuals wanting to come here from the EU. So it's not EU citizens' rights, it's EU citizens' rights currently in the UK.
Yeah, it is. And it sets out, I guess, first of all, the changes that are going to be in place in terms of between now and whatever this cut-off date will be. So I think Theresa May said that the cut-off date will be no sooner than Article 50 day, but no later than Brexit day. And so it sets out essentially what's going to happen to people who are already here and have already been living here, what happens to people who arrive here in the interim between now and this cut-off date. What it doesn't really set out is what our immigration policy will be post-Brexit. So I guess that's what it's setting out for now. But I think the point which I kind of make about this is that it's very, very likely to change, and there's already been pushback. I mean, there was pushback as soon as this was announced, before the detailed document even came out. There was pushback from the other side saying that this isn't what we're expecting and it potentially doesn't go far enough. So the odds that this gets changed and the EU fights us on some of this is quite high, I reckon.
How important is this? How important are citizens' rights? Because I tend to think of Brexit as more about trade and doing our own trade deals, but this seems to be quite important to the EU.
Yeah, and that's my gut reaction. And I said, I've actually not got a great deal of evidence to, hard evidence to back this up, but my gut reaction is I think this is going to be really, really important. And I think to get our heads around that, we need to think about how the EU itself and how the Commission sees the role, both current and future, of the Union and what it's for. Mm. And what we've seen certainly under the more recent treaties, particularly Nice and then Lisbon, is that real concept that there is a genuine concept of EU citizenship. That was laid out in the very early days in sort of Maastricht about wanting to get there. That's absolutely there. So all rights enjoyed by any citizen of any member state of the EU are directly applicable in all other member states. Now, the document we got from the EU earlier this year, kind of setting out their negotiation stance and their broad guidelines, was pretty punchy in terms of what it wanted. What they kind of laid out was, obviously, this is kind of the easy bit in many ways, the rights that citizens gain by virtue of the EU treaties will apply to all UK and EU citizens up until the date of exit, so mm-hmm. that everything remains a status quo. So the idea of trying to trip anything in earlier than 29th of March 2019, there is no way that will go on. But the document from the EU absolutely was clear that what it really wants is all of those rights enjoyed by EU citizens today to continue into the future. Mm. So rights not only that you... Sorry, it's a bit of a complex area. The rights should be enjoyed not only by those EU citizens in the UK at the point of the UK leaving the EU, but also all EU citizens who have ever been in the UK before that date, even if they have left and gone back to their states. And then also that the EU rights around family members are also protected. So this could be a case of EU citizen who came to the UK, worked here for 5 or 6 years, 10 years ago, left, and he's now in a different member state, and potentially maybe their children are in another member state, that that person and their family maintain their rights to movement into and out of the UK with all of the associated work permit, access to social security, healthcare, pensions, etc. Now, that's a big ask.
It is.
And it's hard to imagine that we'll end up at that end of the debate. But I think the fact that their kind of starter for 10 was so unbelievably bold, for me, suggests actually for the EU, this is really, really important. You know, and I think on the two statements, you know, where Theresa May gave her quick statement over dinner early last week, broadly kind of highlighting what was going to be in the paper. They said that was one, the EU, so that was a great first step, but nowhere near sufficient. Essentially, the paper that was laid before Parliament earlier this week, which goes a little bit further and sets out in more detail, got exactly the same response.
Now, just refresh my memory. Was this the proposal put to Parliament, or was tried to be put to Parliament, that they wanted to secure EU citizens' rights before the negotiations began? Am I right in thinking that?
It's the bit that both the EU and the and the UK said, we want to get on with this and do it early. The UK said, look, we're happy to just crack on and do this before we start negotiations. At this point, we haven't actually triggered Article 50. The EU said, we're negotiating nothing until you've instigated the process. So, you know, we are not at liberty to talk to you until Article 50 is notified.
So, I mean, we've been speaking on this now for best part of 9 minutes, and it's clearly an enormous subject. I can't help but think that when the MPs on both sides were calling for this just to be done before the negotiations in, you know, a week or two, they didn't really have an idea of the complexity involved or the size of it.
No, that's right. And I think we talked about this in one of the earlier podcasts, where I think I highlighted the problem is everyone started banding around from the very early days of the Brexit being decided on. We need to protect citizens' rights. And the problem is, right, that word rights in that sentence is doing an awful lot of work. Because people say, oh, you have the right to what? Do you have the right to work under a work permit? Is that work permit transferable? So is it applicable only for that employer and for that job, which is the common way that work permits from non-EU states are handled? Does it include right to remain? So if you cease that job or you cease working, are you allowed to stay in the UK? Does it give you access to the education system? Does it give you access to NHS treatment? Does it give you access to out-of-work benefits, maternity benefits, child tax credits? Does it give you access to pensions? Does it give you those rights for your spouse, for your children, for any other dependents? Does it give you the right to leave the country and come back without reapplication? This is the problem. When you start to talk about rights, is what do you mean? And of course, at the far end of that is citizenship.
Yeah.
You know? So when you say, yes, we're going to protect rights, unless you can go to the nth degree and say which ones, it's a meaningless statement.
So it would be fairly easy, I imagine, to say, right, EU citizens can have exactly the same rights as UK citizens. But actually, at the moment, EU citizens have better rights in the UK than existing citizens, if that makes sense. So can you just outline the difference, or some of the differences, that existing citizens have as opposed to EU citizens?
Okay, so the really big one, and I guess if anyone sort of, you know, takes a bit of a look at this in the press, the one that will always come through is about rights of spouses and dependents. So the challenge here is, as you said, EU citizens in the UK have greater rights by virtue of the EU treaties to bring over their spouses or their children into the UK than pure UK citizens and immigrants from any other country outside the EU. So for example, let's take an example. A British citizen marries an American citizen, wants to bring the American citizen to the UK to live with them. The husband, will be subject to minimum earnings requirements to do so. So this was changed actually under a fairly vicious Home Secretary, who's currently Prime Minister, as part of the tightening down on migration rules. So essentially that means that if you marry somebody, they do not have automatic right of access to the UK. You've got to show that they're earning enough money. Now, lots of other countries around the world have rules similar to this. But usually it's about the clause that can you support yourself.
Can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
How come we were allowed to put that restriction in place as part of the EU?
Because it doesn't apply to EU citizens, essentially. So EU citizens have those rights. So if it was a British citizen marrying a French person, then EU rights go. But so you're not obliged. No member state's obliged to apply those rights to non-EU citizens.
Of course, yes.
And a lot of this is interesting because it kind of flows back to some of the other things we've talked about. A lot of this stuff is in UK government hands to change. It's just the way we've decided to do it. And often a lot of this also reflects, you know, the concerns over things like migrant benefits. And is actually our system works differently to pretty much every other system in the developed world. So in most other countries, even as a citizen of that country, your rights to draw down on social security and health access to health is predicated on some form of engagement with the system. Mm-hmm. So some form of already contributing. So essentially a contributory social benefit system. Wind the clock back, we used to have that in the UK. You know, the amount of state pension you got that's now changed completely, but historically the amount of state pension you got would have been related to the amount of NI stamps you've collected.
Yep.
Over your working career. But access to healthcare or access to unemployment benefits was never really done like that. You know, access to unemployment benefits now is done on household income rather than anything else. Every other member state of the EU, pretty much every other developed economy, has this kind of contributory system where your unemployment benefits are time limited, and if you've not paid in enough, then you don't get them in the first place. And so we changed all of our other systems to try and get around the fact that our benefit system on the whole, our health system, is all non-contributory. It's there, you just draw it down. So, you know, fighting back against a lot of the Brexit narrative, particularly about kind of people come here to draw down on the benefit system, despite the fact all the evidence shows that that's not the case, made the government look to try and clamp down in other ways. So, sorry, that was a very long answer to the question, but this one around spouses and dependents is, I think, going to be one of the big ones for the EU. So there is this challenge as Alex said earlier in your question, essentially the UK's own way of doing this is worse than the EU minimum.
So who do the EU want to oversee the maintenance of EU citizens' rights? Have they got someone in mind for that? Are they happy just for the UK courts to make sure that all this stuff is upheld?
No, their ideal position, I think, is that they want the ECJ to do that.
Brilliant.
Theresa May's position is that that's not going to happen. And but David Davis says that there will be some oversight and it has to be a supranational court. And I saw a rumour today that they're already considering setting up some kind of new organisation which will oversee the rights of our citizens.
Yeah, and in many ways they'll have to be, because whatever the treaty that comes out, because people always kind of forget about this bit, is you know, our membership of the EU is a treaty. It's a standard international treaty serviced in the normal ways that international treaties are served. Amendments to that and whatever goes in its place will also be an international treaty. Mm-hmm. It will just be bilateral between the UK and the EU. A body will have to police the adherence to those statements. Most of these things, when you do them internationally, there is a supranational body that does it. It could go through The Hague, which is where most big multilateral treaty agreements go through. In this case, because it's just going to be UK EU, the likelihood, as Alex said, I think, and Davis has hinted at, is we'll end up with a new UK EU court to look over the treaties.
This kind of strikes me a bit weirdly, and I guess in hindsight it's something that which everyone should have realised would have happened, but it feels to me like, well, it is happening, that the EU is essentially exerting its influence over our policies even post-Brexit, because obviously we've got to come to some kind of deal. But it strikes me as a bit odd that they are kind of pushing back on what our proposed arrangements would be even after the day that we've left. And obviously we all know that immigration was a part of the referendum, and you know the government policy is that they want to restrict freedom of movement and control immigration some more in some way, and the EU is aware of this angle as well. And if essentially the EU are saying that our migration policy post Brexit has to be completely in line with what the EU's is currently, then what I'm wondering is, are we going to have any wiggle room at all? At what point might we be able to, you know, take this increased control?
I think the challenge is it all comes down to the deal. So I think that, you know, I've spoken to a few friends like this who say, look, it's, you know, the migration is not an issue, you can do whatever you like, and off we go and sign a trade deal. I think the big challenge for the UK here, of course, is the bit, you know, no one is, let's just take a step back. There will be some form of free trade agreement between the UK and the EU. It's almost impossible to imagine a scenario where that doesn't take place. Could it be really comprehensive in terms of covering all manufactured goods, possibly even agriculture and fisheries? Perfectly possible. Is it going to be in a big way dealing with the services sector? Probably not. And that's where I think the challenge is going to come. Free trade agreements in goods are relatively straightforward. Lots of countries do them. The services bit, of course, the single market is hugely important. The UK is an overwhelmingly dominated service sector economy. It's where we are the most competitive. So, I mean, there's some interesting, I think, stress room for the EU here. As we will start to look at what the services side of that agreement looks like, it knows we are more competitive than the EU is on services. So actually the EU has a bit more pulling power here and will probably be a bit more defensive. Now the challenge, the flip side is, as we've seen over the past kind of 20 years, more trade agreements come out globally, whether bilaterally or multilaterally, that include aspects of services. The thing that's important in terms of crossing border for services is people. So historically, free trade agreements around goods are all about, yes, getting the tariffs down, but increasingly about getting the non-tariff barriers down. How do you enable those goods to get across the border really easily without being held up? Mm-hmm. The flip side to do that with services is actually what you need is people to be able to move across borders really easily. And that's kind of where the single market actually works. You know, there's all sorts of downsides and we don't need to go into those, but broadly, it works because all of that can happen. Which means increasingly the newer free trade agreements we've seen globally, and we saw this from the evidence when Theresa May went to talk to India last year about opening up discussions with them, was, that's cool, let's have a chat, and let's also make sure we're talking about how many visas we're issuing.
Yeah.
So visas and migration policy is inherently becoming a greater and greater part of free trade agreements as we go forward. Mm-hmm. So it's not a case of is the EU kind of being really strong over this and can it screw the UK government for everything it wants? The point is we want a deal.
Yeah.
And if we want a deal that's got a good chunk of services in, which is where we'll do really well, then migration is going to be on the table.
Mm. Because it actually plays in our favour also. It just doesn't play in our favour politically.
No, I think that's the challenge. But also, I think there's probably less of a challenge if we can get beyond, you know, the noisy rhetoric of the opposing side of the politics and this and the press. Because even, you know, I always say this, you know, even in the UKIP manifesto, the line was controlling migration.
Yes.
It's not necessarily about reducing. Even Farage at his, you know, shouty moments, he could envisage a situation where there was a controlled migration policy which essentially had net inflows similar to today. It was, you know, for them, it was, you know, very much it's the free movement aspect. You can just come in as it were, you know, when and whenever you like, without any checks. Of course, the point is the treaties do allow us to boot people out after 3 months if they're not in work. But because we don't keep a border control system which allows you to keep track of it, we've never enforced it. But every other member state does.
So let's just move this on slightly. Do you think this debate, this part of the negotiation, is going to be a bellwether for does Brexit mean Brexit or does Brexit mean EU just by a different name?
Alex?
It's going to come down to that. And I think the kind of suspicions from the hard levers that this whole thing is going to be, I guess, in their eyes, kind of made a mess of and we're not really going to do Brexit properly is probably an all-time high right now. Because of the whole thing, you know, that we capitulated on the first day and there's already the pushback against the citizens' rights things. I mean, we're not that far into negotiations and already...
No, there's been one meeting, that's it. We've done one meeting so far.
Yeah, and it already feels like, you know, we're going to have to bend significantly more than we want to. So, I think that debate's going to rage on for years and years and years, I would imagine, whether is Brexit Brexit or are we just going to be in the EU in all but name kind of thing. I think there's some interesting angles to it. But this whole citizens' rights things, I find it very interesting because. Sorry, I've completely lost my train of
thought. It's okay because, I mean, it is interesting because Task Force 50 is going to sit there with its parameters, and if the UK tries to negotiate outside of these parameters, it's just going to get nowhere. until it goes back, right?
Yeah, and I think this is the problem. It's, you know, it's, this is one of the aspects that, you know, I've kind of maintained throughout, and the kind of the particularly the harder Brexiteers have always pushed back against, saying, look, you know, we, you know, the EU, we've always said, you know, the EU has the upper hand in this.
Yeah.
By sheer virtue of size, and by sheer virtue of we are the ones walking.
Yeah.
That's just kind of natural. But there's always been this kind of argument that, oh no, it's not you know, but the we can negotiate. Of course we can negotiate. We both start off, the two sides will start off at opposite ends of the line, and they will find the middle ground.
That's the point that I was just going to make before I forgot what I was going to say. Was how much do you think that the government put this bill on citizens' rights forward, knowing that there would be a pushback? I mean, do you really think that they thought that they just put this on the table and it would be accepted? Or are they expecting that there's going to be compromise and all this stuff? Is that the hand that they're playing? I'm not sure.
I thought this was the one that they're going to put through really, really quickly, really early, in order to show some goodwill. That's what I assumed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the other thing for me is, I hope government did not think this will be accepted as it is. Because if they genuinely do think that, then we're in trouble. Yes. We're in a lot of trouble. I think this is, you know, here's your start of a 10. Mm. But I think the fact that it's so vague on the detail, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there, to be fair. But actually, when you get into things like dependents, children, student migration, what happens over the long term, the fact none of that is even talked about is, for me, a little bit worrying. Because actually, and the worst thing as well is, we published the document, and then you've got people like Boris Johnson going in the press saying, look, we've put our thing on the table, it'll be interesting to see what the EU's counter is. And it's like, we've already seen the EU's counter. When the Parliament and the Council put their things down. So actually, this is the counter-offer. What you've just put on the table is the counter-offer. And the fact they were so clear, you know, the EU document is unbelievably detailed in what it wants. The fact you've not even responded to the questions they set, just again in all of this, leaves me feeling a bit nervous.
Just going off on a tangent, if there was a point where the UK could persuade the EU to give ground, would that be quite public? Would you see Task Force 50 have to report back to the Council or the European Parliament in order to get extra permissions? And would that be publicly known?
Well, I think everything from the EU side is publicly known. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, other commentators have said this kind of thing. The really, really sad and disappointing thing in all this is, you know, someone who's on the, you know, is a UK citizen here and wants to see Britain do well out of this, is the single best port of information for everything that's going on in the negotiations.
Website's really good, actually, isn't it?
Is the European Commission, who are publishing everything and are being really open.
Well, I would just counter that and say, you know, negotiating with Task Force 50 is like negotiating with Apple terms and conditions. You know, you don't have much leeway. And if both sides did that, I mean, there wouldn't be anything to discuss, really.
No, there wouldn't. And I think that's a huge challenge. And it'll be interesting to see how things go. You know, I think, as Alex said earlier, I think the outcome of this bit, the citizens' rights, will give a pretty good indication of where things are going to go over the longer term. But all of this highlights the sheer power of the EU.
What does it highlight? Belligerence and intransigence, I don't know.
Very probably it does, but the point is I don't think the two things are necessarily separable. Mm. Because the EU has delegated its rights down to Barnier and Task Force 50. The Parliament has set out what it wants to see out of this. After that, the Council set out a more detailed document setting out not only that this is what it's to see, but that explicitly states this is what Barnier can work within.
Yeah.
Okay? So the Council has set out what it wants, and he's sending the negotiator in saying, you have our permission to do anything you like within this.
Yes.
So as soon as we start to move away significantly from that, they are going to have to go back and get council permission.
I wonder how much of this could actually hinge on how clever Barnier is. If he wanted to negotiate a deal, maybe putting it in the right language to be acceptable back to the council.
Yeah, I think there's that. And I think there's also, I think from the EU side, more room for manoeuvre than perhaps the official documents suggest. Mm. If you look at that thing of the history of the EU, the way it's just helped things along over the years. Now, depending on what side you are and your political bias, you'll have different opinions on what helping along means. But issues around, you know, getting the Lisbon Treaty through, you know, Denmark and Ireland when they turned it down, all sorts of other things. Actually, the EU is a pretty good fudger. For all of its massive, massive reliance on colossal bureaucracy and detailed documents and treaties, it has on innumerable occasions over its life fudged issues to help them through. The EU wants a decent deal out of all this, but it does have the upper hand. And it's one thing we've talked about for a while, and it'd just be nice for the UK government, from my point of view at least, to kind of stop the stick waving. And whilst I understand it probably doesn't want to publicly acknowledge the EU as an upper hand, I'd like to see something in the documents and the tone which suggests they've at least privately recognised that.
Well, you did mention political leanings. Let's talk about Tory leanings, or more particularly, Tory splits. Last week has been full of Boris, Hammond, Davis, all not really having a coherent view on Brexit. So what do we know about the Tory position? Has it changed? And will this change anything in the negotiations?
I think we were talking about this before the podcast, that it isn't really even just the Tories. It kind of seems like particularly Conservatives and Labour are kind of still split on Brexit and are even wavering from their manifestos in many ways. But the big story, which I think was the top story in the Times today, I think, about the Tory split between Hammond, Davis and Boris. I mean, Hammond's been around doing a few speeches this week, and he's been kind of taking digs at Boris with, you know, making little jokes and things like that. And then apparently Hammond and Davis are also arguing because Philip Hammond suggested that the transition deal would be like something like 4 or 5 years, whereas David Davis is saying it will be only 2. I think Philip Hammond is taking a much... He's using the line transitional arrangement, whereas David Davis is sticking to the whole... What's he calling it? Begins with an I. Implementation phase. And it's like they're arguing over these little terms. But the point which I made about this was that if you go back 6 months ago, I think they would have been arguing about whether there should be a transition period. Whereas now they're not arguing about whether there should be one. They're just arguing about how long it should be.
What interests me about this are the personalities putting forward their viewpoints. And I wonder if they're putting forward these viewpoints almost as an advertisement to a Tory membership,
yes,
saying, hang on a minute, there could be a change of leader, and this is how I would handle Brexit. I'm almost certain that is the case, actually.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. I certainly think there's some of that in there. David Davis is obviously trying to appeal much more to the Brexiteers. Hammond is trying to appeal much more to the pragmatists. But they're kind of they're sort of closing in on a position.
And yeah. I wonder what Andrea Leadsom thinks.
I think I said it before that they are arguing amongst themselves, but they're arguing in a much kind of smaller scope than they perhaps were 6 months ago. It's happening in the Labour Party as well. We're still seeing Keir Starmer going back to the whole he thinks we can stay in the single market. And then that's definitely the best route, which completely is not what their manifesto says. And obviously, I won't talk too much about Corbyn wavering on things that have been said in the manifesto, but that's happening too. And so it seems like every party really is having its own kind of internal issues.
Yeah. Do you guys have any preference to... this is more of a general chamber question, but do you have any preference to which of the routes is best, softer, harder?
I think we try and stay neutral and kind of don't have a position. I think
we've got the position statements, which absolutely lay out what the membership's looking for. Mm-hmm. And even that is kind of treading a line because, of course, actually our membership is pretty heavily divided. There's no overwhelming vote one way or the other. But they are pretty clear on actually the benefits of the single market need to be protected before you come up with something else. Mm-hmm. So make sure you don't fall out of things before you've got something in place. Grandfathering of existing trade agreements, both with the EU and with third countries, should take preference over being able to sign other new ones.
Yeah. Mm.
So don't fall out of all of that aspect until you've got something in place. So basically the position is don't rush this and foul it up. It's probably the way to summarise a pretty chunky document.
Yeah, I think Adam Marshall from British Chambers of Commerce was on Bloomberg talking about this, and the way he put it I thought was quite nice, is that if businesses are going to have to make adjustments to some new changes or some new regulations or new legislation, let's just have it happen once. You know, we don't want to have these steps where suddenly everything changes and then 6 months later something else changes. We need there to be this is what's coming up, it's going to happen on this day, you've got all this time to prepare, and there's one change and one adjustment. Like, if we can get it down to that process, and I guess that's what we're looking for.
A couple of weeks ago, we mentioned, it might have been last week actually, we mentioned it might be useful if Brexit was a little bit more cross-party. Now, it doesn't look like it's going to be explicitly cross-party, but we have had Keir Starmer being sworn onto the Privy Council. Does this mean anything?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure it does. When I saw this announcement, there were people on Twitter saying that it means essentially that Keir Starmer will now be being briefed by David Davis on how the negotiations are going. But I don't see how it means that Keir Starmer will have any influence over how the negotiations go. And I'm not quite sure.
But it would mean
is the Privy Council more just a ceremonial thing? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. But I mean, let's just presume. Well, yeah, let's not presume anything. But I'm going to presume anyway.
Yeah.
Let's presume that it is something fairly important. It would give Keir Starmer a lot of leverage when holding David Davis to account. So I guess in a sense, it's almost cross-party by the back door.
Yeah, and I think it will be Starmer trying to hold Davis to account, because I think Starmer's position is broadly in line with perhaps Hammond's position, which is interesting in and of itself. I know there's been murmurings that Hammond might be the person to take over May come the Tory party conference. And if that happens, there's potentially going to be agreement between the Prime Minister and the lead negotiator on the other side, which will be an interesting situation.
Yeah. I don't suppose you know anything about the Privy Council or its role or its importance?
In detail, no. I'm looking at sort of some things here. I think there's probably fairly major issues about, whilst it's an extremely long-lived body, it goes back over centuries, the oath hasn't changed since the 16th century, all that kind of stuff, actually, as to just how meaningful it is. So yes, it does things like signing off secondary legislation. That's its role. Well, actually, the quora for a meeting of the Privy Council is actually only three. People who are appointed to the Privy Council are appointed for life. Certainly, so there will be a very large number
of
members of it. Yeah, so anyone who has been or is a cabinet secretary or major shadow secretary is in there.
So I guess the answer to my original question is no.
It's probably not in any no. meaningful and tangible sense for what we're talking about.
No, it actually almost certainly isn't. So let's leave that right there. Now, Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce is always asking its members about various bits and pieces. You guys have conducted a poll. Would you like to tell me something about it?
Yeah, so this was a poll conducted by British Chambers of Commerce straight after the general election. Just a little poll, some questions basically on the end of a survey which we do regularly about Brexit and people's thoughts on it in the context of the election result particularly. It was fairly interesting, because I think it kind of shows perhaps a kind of broad shift in the way that members are feeling about this. And again, it could be just the people that decided to answer these questions. But it looks to me basically like an outright rejection of the way that the government is kind of handling this. The first question, first of all, was, do you feel that the needs of businesses are being prioritised currently in the Brexit negotiations? And 59% went with disagree. Mm-hmm. So there's broad agreement really that people don't think that the government is taking the needs of business into account enough at this stage. And then there are a few questions really just about the general strategy, where we should go. Should we reconsider our negotiating position? I think following the general election, the result was that 58% of respondents said that the negotiating position should be reconsidered, so that we should perhaps step away from the kind of 12 headline negotiating objectives which were set out months and months ago, perhaps have a cross-party chat over how to take things forward. And then the other interesting one was that, again, there was a kind of a more strong rejection of leaving the single market and the customs union than we've seen before in these types of surveys. So 55% answered that they'd like us to stay in both the single market and the customs union. There was 17% saying we should stay in the customs union but not in the single market, which I think is an interesting position, perhaps a podcast all of its own. And then a further 18% think we should stay in the single market but leave the customs union. And if you add all that up together, it's, you know, you're looking at more than three quarters of the respondents think that we should stay in the single market or the customs union or both. So it seems to me like an outright rejection of hard Brexit from from the membership. And I guess going back to the first question, which is quite interesting about how they feel that business needs aren't being prioritised. We've had the news this week that there's been a business advisory group set up by the government.
Yes.
So this group's been set up, and it's going to be essentially the heads of various business representative organisations like the British Chambers of Commerce and the Federation of Small Business and the Institute of Directors and the Engineering and whatever it is.
Employers Federation, Employers EF, and the CBI. Yeah.
And the CBI, yeah. So the leaders of all those are going to be meeting up weekly, I believe, with Greg Clark. And basically, yeah, trying to relay what businesses are saying about all this. And I believe that David Davis is going to be in those meetings fortnightly too. Mm. Which is interesting because, I said before that I'm not sure if it's my confirmation bias coming through, but I'm starting to see more and more moves towards this being much softer than people might have anticipated a few months ago. And that certainly seems to be the view of businesses. I mean, look at any of the surveys that any of these organisations have done, and businesses essentially are asking for a soft Brexit. So I'm going to be very interested to see how much influence this group actually exerts over how the negotiations are taken forward.
Do you think this might be one of the unforeseen advantages of having a weaker government, which is the Brexit process is softening but also becoming more consensual, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. And I also wonder that we've not tested this in the survey work, and it might come out over the coming months. But how much of kind of this shift we've seen in the latest polling is down to colossal uncertainty being shown from government's side.
Mm.
So actually, you know, despite lots of our members possibly even disagreeing with aspects of that 12-point plan that the Prime Minister gave back in January, actually welcomed it broadly, saying at least we know where we're going. I don't like it, but I understand we are where we are. Crack on, deliver this, and we'll go with it. And I do wonder how much of the shift is about you've not got a plan, have you? You sold us that you were going to do this, we'll get on. All of that's kind of fizzled away. And the general response, A, from the business community, B, I think we've seen broadly from the population in terms of general election result, is, hang on a minute, this is not quite what we were being sold.
Just massive interest, you guys deal with businesses on a daily basis. How well equipped are big businesses to be talking about things like international treaties?
Well, in terms of actual treaties themselves, very few will have any idea. I mean, in the sense that, I doubt there are many more than a few hundred people in the world who seriously understand all of that sort of stuff. But I think what they are hugely equipped to talk about, and it's one of the ways we tend to survey our members, and we did not long after the referendum, is in terms of talking about the aspects of what those things deliver that they enjoy and see as useful. So this is an unusual survey recently because we asked specifically about single market and customs union. Historically, what we asked them to talk about is what are the things that our membership of the EU gives them that's beneficial, so they can talk about, actually, we like the idea that there are absolutely no border hold-ups. Mm-hmm. We like the idea that actual documentation procedures to get goods into the EU are relatively straightforward. We like the idea that actually we're to surf on the back of the free trade agreements or other bilateral treaties with the countries is good. Lack of bureaucracy in terms of bringing EU nationals to work here. So by asking those sorts of questions, you realise actually business does know a lot and can talk through sheer practical experience. Do they know the definition of what the customs union actually is? Mm-hmm. Actually, the interesting bit is we tend to increasingly find no. Yeah. We don't. And they talk about, a lot of the time, the things they talk about, ease of regulation, no stopping at borders, all that kind of stuff, they say that it's really important we keep the customs union for that. And we say, well, that's great, but those rights don't come to you through the customs union. They come to you through other ways. So it is complex. So answer the question, do businesses know about that stuff at the big level? No, in terms of how they benefit and where they're worried about seeing disbenefits coming, absolutely they're aware.
Excellent. Right, gents, do you want to add anything else before we finish us off?
I think I'm just going to, I'd like to just finish off actually by taking us back to the citizens' rights bit.
Yes, please.
Because while we've all been talking, I've just been rereading the European Council's.
Did notice you busily tapping away there.
Absolutely, revisiting the European Council's statement. So this is the negotiating document. This is the recommendation for a council decision authorising the opening of negotiations for an agreement with the UK. So this is the document essentially which Barnier has to work to. Everything in here is what the council has said he can go and do. And there's a chunky section on citizens' rights, but I'm just going to touch on one bit of it. We says the agreement should safeguard, so the agreement, that which actually comes out and is signed, the agreement should safeguard the states and status and rights derived from union law at the withdrawal date. Okay, fine, that's all nice and clear. Including those of the enjoyment of which will intervene at a later date. So, for example, old age pensions.
Yeah,
because that might be 40, 50 years away from people. For EU 27 citizens residing in or having resided and working in or having worked in the UK, and then the flip side for the other way around, and that it's all reciprocal. And I think that's the really important bit. So it's not only that they're here now, but they've ever been here, mm-hmm. and vice versa, or ever worked here. And the definition of the persons to be covered, economically active, workers, self-employed, inactive persons, so you didn't have to be working here, you could just be family member of someone who was. So it's an their offer. You know, this is what Barnier has to negotiate within,
so,
and it's incredibly bold.
You said it had to be reciprocal.
So whatever the UK offers EU citizens, the EU must offer UK. So it's, you know, it's an absolute equal swap in that sense.
Well, I was going to close off the podcast, but we'll just go a little bit more into this. From a negotiation point of view, if it is reciprocal for UK citizens to go over to the EU, what is the real downside here from a political point of view? Is it that the EU don't control their borders well enough, we don't know who all the EU citizens are, or is it something else? Is it that we just don't want these rights for our citizens, or we don't need them? What's the issue here?
My gut reaction is it's just political. And I think, you know, I've not talked about this in detail with many other people, but actually it's something I'm going to try and do over the next few weeks with my both Remain and Brexiter friends, is actually unpick all of this. You know, because my gut reaction is if you say to your average Brexiter, look, what the EU wants is basically every EU citizen who's ever been here, who aren't, those who are, and of course the cut-off date will be in the future now, so anyone who comes between now and us leaving gets lifetime rights that they enjoy now for themselves and for their family for the duration until those people die. I suspect a lot will push back and say that's absolutely outrageous and impossible, but I suspect if you kind of drill down and chat in this kind of way that you just said, this means that actually you get the rights to go over the UK, your family get the rights in the longer term. I suspect it's something you could probably diffuse.
I think I've said before that I think there's more wiggle room in terms of freedom of movement within the single market than people realise. And it strikes me as if we were to just come out and say, you know what, we're literally going to copy and paste the current rights that EU citizens have here. We're not going to change anything. We're just going to agree to just continue as things are. But we'd like them to have ID cards. That potentially gets around the problem of, you know, appeasing the EU, but allowing us to control who, or at least see who we've got coming in and out, mm-hmm. a lot more. And I believe that there's other countries around the EU who have identification systems that don't.
Pretty much all of them. We're odd in that sense.
So in a way, we could agree to just continue things as they are, but we could align ourselves more directly with some other EU countries, and you basically solve the let's control immigration more problem along with it. So,
well, I mean, if I was David Davis now, I'd probably be coming back to the UK public and saying something along the lines of, you'll never guess what rights I've secured for you within the EU.
Exactly, yeah. Now, can you flip it? How do you paint this argument? Yeah. You know, it's something we often talk about here, particularly in policy.
It's a great victory.
Narrative matters. Where, you know, it's absolutely been focused from Davis and, you know, the kind of the pro-Brexit side. It's all been about this fight with the EU and how do we clamp things down, rather than actually, how do we flip it and say that, you know, something positive can come out of this? I think the hard bit politically will probably be the bit between now and 2019 and actual leaving. Because I suspect the Brexit side has a good potential, I think, to paint the picture of, look, how do you stop, this won't happen, how do you stop 3 million EU migrants landing at Dover 5 minutes before the treaties cease? And I think that is probably actually quite a hard one. But actually, I guess you could make the same case of what do you do if all the British pensioners land on the Costa del Sol?
Yeah, I mean, surely the smart thing for UK workers would be to go another stint now in the EU.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Yeah. If you want to secure those rights, if you like the idea of EU citizenship for yourself and your family, then get yourself a 3-month work placement out there.
There was talk, wasn't there, of being able to buy EU citizenship in the future?
Yeah, this was raised by the EU itself, yeah, as the idea of can we create a flexible EU citizenship which the UK people who want it can buy into. But as I suspect, you know, careful negotiation around this should be able to kind of solve that anyway.
Right, let's leave it there. If you want to get in contact with us or join the debate, please follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. Alex?
I'm at @JMCC_Alex.
And Christian?
I'm at @JMCC_Christian.
Fantastic. And of course, please leave us those iTunes reviews. They are very important. Until next week, goodbye.